Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune into 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
And the crowd went narcoleptic. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoy Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Sweet Home, Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. Thanks, guys. Every little bit helps. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. Excuse me. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe that families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. So does the country. Basically, so does the world. We have found that most of the dilemma we have with drugs and alcohol come from children not being taught correct principles. Once a child is taught correct principles, they can teach themselves. But if those principles aren't taught, morality and some common sense, as a matter of fact, common sense isn't as common as you might think, they grow up in the clubs and the gangs, and they learn the mean from the mean streets, latchkey kids and empty lot weed. So they turn to drugs, sex, and rock and roll. It's a dilemma. It costs the nation billions upon billions of dollars. Most of the people we have in prison, I think the statistics came out, was like 82 or 83% of everyone who's in prison today is drug or alcohol related in some extent. Now, of course, there's career criminals, and you're always going to have your horse thief looking for a free ride, and they'll always be with us. But the majority are there because of drugs and alcohol. It's a huge cost to society. And besides the families, each one of these guys in there usually is part of a family of some, a father, a brother, you know, with parents and all that. All that cost, all that loss of productivity, loss of life. It's a horrendous problem in this country and in the world. So we're trying to address it the best we can. If you think you can change the world, it's either grandiose romanticism or politics. You can only change the world one man at a time. And that's our focus, sponsorship. One guy working with another guy, or one girl working with another girl, to try to achieve long-term sobriety, to attain and then maintain long-term sobriety. It really works if it's worked the way it was originally intended to do it. So, Harold, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great tonight, Joseph. Thank you for the great introduction. This is a family illness, and it's a family solution. And it's been an uphill battle, it seems to me, in my recovery to reach out to the families. There seems to be less and less interest in including families and reaching out to families. I've done a couple of interventions recently, couple of weeks ago. It was a total failure. The man wouldn't even sit down and listen to his kids for 1 minute. A very sad situation. And last night I did an intervention that was a success. We got well prepared. Each person there had standing that they cannot cave in. They wrote letters, a five-part letter. The instructions for all this are included on the website, ladies and gentlemen, rumradio.org, on how to do an intervention, and I've done many, many of those. We have about a 50-50 success rate, but it's worth a try. It's worth the effort. I also want to mention that the website and the radio program are funded by, not by you folks, it's by Joseph G. He foots the cost. He doesn't make any money whatsoever on this. In fact, it costs thousands to establish it and maintain it. So I really appreciate him doing that, because that gives me another way that I can give back. And it's by giving back that we really maintain our recovery. Getting sober, getting clean is the first step of it, but then the more difficult part is staying clean and sober, and that we do by working with other people. So all the time I'm helping folks realize that they are working the steps in order to learn how to lead someone new through the steps, and that's when the program really takes hold and transforms your life as well as the new person. So it's a real delight. It's a privilege to be here, and I just want everyone to know that. And I appreciate Joseph for funding the whole thing. That's great, Joseph. Back to you.
Well, thank you, Harold. Well, that's enough about me. Would someone else like to talk about me? That's a joke. There's two parts in the program that I really push home hard, and it's a simple program for complicated people. It's the one immunity we have from alcohol, and that would be drugs as well, is intensive work with another addict or alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. And on step five from the 12 and 12, with 12 steps and 12 traditions, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So what it's saying is, not only do we speak a fifth step, we have to hear a fifth step. Who hears a fifth step? A sponsor hears a fifth step. And until you've heard a fifth step, you still didn't belong. You're circling the field, waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, and then it's another crash and burn. So this is the impetus, this is the direction that we try to go with Rum Radio. The one immunity is intensive work. One drunk talking to another, one addict talking to another, telling them, yeah, you can get well. There is an answer. Give hope. That's what we sell at Rum Radio. We sell hope that there's a solution to this mind-numbing, spiritual-robbing disease. Oh, by the way, disclaimer, this is not AA. This is not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. This is not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closest to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is that nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you're a member of Narcoleptics Anonymous, consider this a wake-up call. Well, we have a special guest tonight. We like to do people of note because they have better jokes. And we also do the regular Joe, but we have a person of note tonight. Melanie's been with us before, Melanie Curtis. So we're excited to hear from you, Melanie. Are you there?
I am.
Okay. If you would just hold on just for a minute, I'm going to have Harold, if you're ready, Harold, how it works from Chapter 5 of the Big Book. I like using the Big Book because it's the original template of all 12-step recovery. So we're going to tell you how it works. You ready, Harold?
I'm ready. Well, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. They're those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we're dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly ask him to remove our... Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, we had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventure before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not save our lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and
God could and would if he were sought. Well, thank you, Harold. That was a great rendition. I'm excited. I like step 10. That to me is really important. I mean, they're all important. Continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong, promptly admitted. I've discovered that it's easier to swallow crow while it's still warm. When it gets cold, it has the bitter aftertaste of egret. Anyway, so, Melanie, you're on. I'm so excited to hear from you. You got so many good things going. I'm so happy that you're here with us and that you're doing the work you're doing. You're saving so many folks. I mean, we don't see it sometimes on ground level, but the work we do is going to reverberate through time. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, I'm glad to be here and certainly glad to share what we're doing. I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit called Supportive Housing and Innovative Partnerships, or SHIP, because that's a lot shorter. And we started out 13 years ago providing safe and sober housing for people in early recovery. And so we currently have 11 houses in Boise, Idaho, and four of which are funded by the VA. So we're working with veterans. We have two that are funded by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and we're working with folks who have been chronically homeless. And then we have I'm a social worker, so I don't know what the math is on that, but the remainder of those houses are a variety of funding sources from the state, private pays. And so we do safe and sober housing with a therapeutic environment. So we use a modified therapeutic community modality to help folks change their behavior so that they can be more successful in long-term recovery. And so,
How about you though? How did you get into that? I mean, you didn't just say one day you woke up one morning and said, "Hey, let's start this." I mean, there must have been a part of it. I'd like to hear some of your journey that got you there, because I know you've sustained tremendous loss, and I have myself, and I understand that sometimes that loss is the kindling or the impetus behind a work. It just works out that way.
Yeah, well, the loss actually happened in about 3 years ago, which was, you know, which is after we started doing SHIP and doing the work with people in recovery. I actually had gone to work for our local housing authority, and they were in a big growth mode to develop more affordable housing. And as I was participating in community meetings throughout our community, I kept hearing about that there was no place to go for people who were coming out of treatment. And what I didn't know initially was in Idaho at that time meant that they were coming out of prison, which, you know, and because in Idaho, 87% of the folks who were incarcerated have some kind of substance use issue on board. So, you know, like the stuff you were talking about earlier certainly my phone may be dying here, but I'll keep talking. And anyway, I'm plugging it in. I started hearing that, and I started researching what could we do in order to help folks have an opportunity to have a new place to go where they weren't going back to where they'd used before, and so they weren't amongst the triggers that they were in, and to help provide a supportive environment. They actually did research and discovered Oxford Houses. And that worked for the state of Idaho because they're not, it's a very, very conservative state. They're not really apt to put any state money into social services. So it was a way where people who needed help could pay a weekly rent, which was a portion. I mean, they basically split up the cost. And so that's what we started doing at first. We found that over time, that model didn't work for us because the folks we were dealing with because you depend on peer accountability. And what we found is when so many of our folks were coming out of prison, they have that don't be a snitch mentality initially. And so we found that we just had to keep adding layer and layer of accountability to help deal with that. So over the years, we basically modified it. Now we do a modified therapeutic community, which means we do push-ups and pull-ups. And if you've got three, and the pull-ups are the negative behaviors. If you have three pull-ups of a similar nature, then we work with you to develop a behavioral contract where you decide what kind of help you need. So it's really that it's the person's plan, but we help monitor for them and, you know, and remind them of what they've agreed to and those kinds of things. So
it does the 12 steps come in
well?
Huh? Excuse me?
That sounds like it really worked.
Yeah, what? I'm sorry.
That sounds like it really works well.
It has. It definitely has. I especially like the program we've been able to develop with the Veterans Administration, or Veterans Affairs, I mean, because that program we actually have a program that is a step-down program. We have one that is actually staffed 24/7, because our other houses aren't staffed, but we have one that's staffed 24/7. So if we have somebody who's coming directly out of the residential substance abuse treatment or they're coming out of the psychiatric ward, we actually have staff that's there 24 hours a day. And so that it helps with some of the issues, helps people stabilize, and then they're there for up to 6 months, and we're able to step them down in our grant per diem program, which isn't staffed 24/7. And so they get time to get used to our system and make changes before they go into something that's less restrictive. And so, which enables us to actually work with somebody for 2.5 years if they need that much time, which when you think about addiction, how long people have it and how many bad habits have been developed, if it's taken you 20 years to get to that point, you certainly need more than 30 days or 28 days or whatever to figure out what you need to change in your behavior to be successful.
Did you work the 12 steps at all with that, or is that you've already done that? And
Well, we do require as a part of our contract that people do participate in, it can be a 12-step fellowship, it can be something else. Our rationale for that is that we want them to develop new friendships and with people who are in recovery too. So some people don't want to do AA, so we certainly allow them to do Smart Recovery. There's also Celebrate Recovery, and we let them include church. If they go to church and get involved with their church, that counts too, because our goal is to get them to develop new relationships with people who aren't using. So we certainly support AA and NA and any 12-step, but we also have a philosophy that there are many pathways, and if that pathway doesn't work for somebody, we're certainly open to them developing other alternatives. So, in fact, we have a new program that had started about a year ago that we're doing with our veterans that we work with that we call Recovery Wellness. And the director of Recovery Wellness is a person who's trained in holistic nutrition. She's also a certified recovery coach. And recovery coaching is different than like sponsorships. It's peer-to-peer. And unlike a sponsorship, the sponsor, there's a power differential. So we use the recovery coach model where it's a peer that's helping you navigate the system that they've been through. And so, but, you know, she also tries to get them involved in eating appropriately because that's going to help them feel better, getting them involved in activities like yoga. We do an art class once a month. She does cooking classes and explains to them, you know, by eating, you know, this, by eating this certain thing that, you know, it can help you with the cravings and things like that. So she's researched a lot of things like that that can help people get, that it can help them recover as well. So we just, we definitely embrace that philosophy of any pathway.
Now, my experience with the 12 steps, it's basically a spiritual illness. You know, the Dr. Jung had written that alcohol on a medieval level was man's search for wholeness with God. And then we see that the alcohol, the spirits, being replaced by that. Do you hold on to that model, or you're a little bit more open as long as they're seeking something?
Well, I think I'm not going to choose for somebody what their path is. I'm going to support them while they're on their path. So, I don't make a decision about that. What we do is try to offer them all the different things that we know of out there. And so, you know, some of the folks we get have a really difficult time with the God part. And so, and we know that, and so we don't force anything at all. I know that there are some programs that are locally that, you know, you have to go to a certain church and you have to do that. And I just, as somebody who believes in religious freedom, can't do that. But I mean, on a personal level, totally believe that it's a spiritual issue. And we have, you know, that and that is the answer. So, but I'm not going to dictate to people.
No, I understand that. I think it's a misunderstanding. There's a lot. Clancy I is? Clancy, you know Clancy. Have you heard of Clancy? He's sort of a iconic figure in AA. He's been around forever. He left a well-paying job in advertising, and he's been working a mission for 35 years in California. Some people love him, some people don't, but he's got a really good program. He goes around a lot. He's a circuit speaker, and he said he had noticed in some pockets of AA that they're trying to ease God out of the rooms. And this, so I wrote to that, and I said, well, you know, it's not so much that AA is easing God out of the rooms. It's the AA finds itself as mirroring the society that it finds itself in. That seems to be the general lay of the land. And I think part of the misunderstanding in AA is that the program of recovery doesn't require you to believe in God. There's many atheists in AA. And the good news is God doesn't require you to believe in him either, because the scriptures say, choose you this day whom you will serve. And this puts all men on equal ground. And the foundation of recovery is choice. You can choose to believe in God, or you could choose not to. I mean, if you want to be an atheist, it's your God-given right to be an atheist.
Well, and, you know, I agree with that, because I don't want to be in a role where I would be dictating, you know, this is the only path, because it isn't my journey to dictate.
Sure.
And so we're there as a support system throughout people's journey. And so I often have people that will come up and say, oh, you know, your program saved my life. And I go, our program didn't save your life. You saved it. You did the work that you needed to do to get there.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And it provided you with an opportunity. Because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to take their success. It's theirs. They've done the hard work to get there. So we are dedicated to providing the support systems to get them there.
Have you ever heard this, Melanie? a lot of people in recovery, and of course, you know, you got the religious right, and then you have the atheist left, and we try to all get along in the program. But a lot of folks on the right will say, well, I was saved by grace. And I'll say, well, wait a minute, let's take a look at that. I says, now, this, according to Google, you know, in 1,000 years from now, the anthropologists will have concluded that as a society, we all commune with an all-knowing God named Google, that there's 140 million drunks in the world. And there's only 2,100,000 in the rooms as of the census, the AA census of 2010. So what's happened to the other 137,900,000? They didn't get grace? What's up with that? I believe that because we took an action. You know, we took certain actions, and we took that action. You know, the scriptures say, the Lord says, you turn towards me, and then I'll turn towards you. Like one good turn deserves another. The magic words in AA is action and more action. The faith without works is dead. So you're expected to take certain actions, and those actions will produce long-term sobriety. What's your take on that?
Yes. Well, I definitely think that's true, but I also believe that it can be a variety of things. I know people that have, they've started running or they've done things like that that has given them something that's pleasurable that they like to do that helps replace that emptiness that the drug was filling.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, I mean, there's just, it's so complicated because each person is different and their experiences are different. We do know that addiction is often tied to childhood trauma. If you were sexually abused as a child, people in that situation have higher instances of addiction. And I think that a lot of times that's trying to soothe that emotional pain. There's all kinds of things out there, but I just try to keep an open mind and I'm thinking if it's working for you, then that's good.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, if the guy's staying sober, that's the bottom line. But we found that the one immunity is intensive work with another alcoholic. Now, you don't have that model at all. You don't have one guy who's got sober, or do you?
Oh, we do have that model in that we do recovery coaching, which is peer-to-peer. So you have somebody who's trained as a recovery coach who then is a person that helps that person navigate the system. And, you know, and helps however that person wants to be helped. And so it's all about peers. One of the things that we're working on putting together right now is a recovery community center. And that will be peer-driven. I mean, it'll be peer-to-peer kinds of services. So, no, I totally embrace that you know, it's one alcoholic or one addict to another. Definitely.
Are you accountable to your coach? Is there an accountability?
Oh, yeah.
Accountable.
Yes.
So there is a power differential then.
No. Don't ask me this stuff about recovery coaching. I'm not trained in it. I have staff that are. And so I would want them to answer those questions. So, because I have not been through the 30 hours of training. But what my understanding is that it's a peer kind of thing where you've got somebody you can talk to about it, and if so, anyway, I would have to.
Yeah, well, I see the sponsor, the way I sponsor, I do it more of a peer. I mean, I take them through the steps. My job is really to introduce them to God. You know, God, him, his work, and God will get him sober. I don't really get him sober, but I get him through the steps.
Right.
to using the big book, and I make it real simple that way because I know I'm dealing with and that's the sanest of complicated people, and the first thing they want to do is complicate this thing. So I try to keep it real simple and keep to the steps and to the big book, you know, and it seems to work. If I can get them to start sponsoring sooner than later, it seems to have, like they take out insurance for the time that they're in an activity working with someone else. You know, when you're working with someone else, you're divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And this is where I believe your conscious contact with God really comes in when you're in that service. Now, I have a hard time just saying that, okay, the guy's a runner now, and he's running a lot, and he's getting his endorphins up. I can't see how that would keep him sober for the long haul. No, I've known guys that have done that.
That isn't what I'm saying. That isn't what I'm saying. I mean, there's a whole, you know, a whole variety of things that people can do. And it's, you know, and most, we definitely are encouraging them to be a part of various meetings. It may not be 12-step. It may be, like I said, smart recovery. It might be a celebrate recovery, but it's getting them together with their peers and dealing with those kinds of things. So, I mean, it's not just, you know, go out and run and that'll keep you sober, but, I mean, because I'll tell you what, for me, that would not be...
I've known guys have done that, though. I've known guys that did that originally, like the first 5 years. They must have ran from here to California 10 times, and it kept them sober because they were running all the time. They never had a chance to drink. But eventually, it didn't work. You know, they had to come up to a higher spiritual level. And we have suicide all the time.
I agree with that.
I wrote to the suicide deal. Do you have suicides over there? Have you had any experience with that in your program?
We have. We actually earlier in the summer, we had a gentleman who had just been discharged from state hospital, and one of the state hospitals, and he came into our house and stabbed himself in the stomach with a butter knife and bled to death. And so, we do. And, yeah, it was very difficult on everybody else that was there. They didn't really have a chance to develop a relationship with him, but just that whole drama that goes along with it. And, you know, we had a very sad family to deal with, and our hearts just went out to them, too. And, yeah, we do have that. Not as much as we did. We had three suicides in 2003, which is what made us realize that we really needed to make sure that we had a mental health component we could tap into, because we didn't have that service at that point. So we were able to figure out some ways to make sure the folks.
There was one I had just written to that on the website, or I expanded the understanding, and I have some good stuff on there. What I've realized, I had an insight into that. We had two fellas just recently at the Post Oak about within the year, and one was a wealthy guy, owned 7 pawn shops, and the other guy was an attorney, had about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the attorney cut his throat. I never heard that one before. He cut his own throat. And the pawnbroker went to the cemetery and blew his brains out. And go like, well, they had long-term sobriety. Why did they do that? And what I've realized is that they had failed, or my assumption is they had failed to increase their spiritual life. And life on life's terms got to be more than they can handle. And they could not conceive of being disloyal to the program of recovery, and the only option to them was the oblivion of suicide, and that actually made them feel good, and they didn't, and no one would know, had a clue, because I think once that happens, they've made up their mind, and there's a certain relief that comes from making that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happens a lot in AA. I've seen it. you know, where they're not, nobody knows, and they have long-term sobriety. So you go, why? Why did they do that? And I believe it's they failed to expand their spiritual life. We would prefer they go out and drink, because now they're still alive and they could come back and it's okay. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. But some people will prefer to kill themselves than to be disloyal to the program. Have you ever heard that before?
Uh-huh. I have not. We actually, come to think of it, we had a person who had worked for us at one time who had long-term recovery who recently relapsed, and I know that she actually felt basically put down and judged and condemned by some of the old-timers. And then, and she ended up killing herself. So, I mean, I'm not blaming anyone, but it's like I think we all, as, you know, AA or whatever community, needs to make sure that we kind of look at addiction as something that's nonlinear. It's like, yeah, you might have clean time, but if you relapse, it's okay. You can, every day you wake up and are breathing, you have an opportunity to turn it
around.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah.
I mean, I think so. We need to be a little, you know, a lot nicer to each other and not be judgmental and not, you know.
My experience is that even the hardcore old-timers will not judge somebody for going out. No, I've never seen that. Usually we the phrase is we welcome back our wounded. We're glad to see you come back. Mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to come back because of the personal shame you feel, not the shame that we're glad to see you. Your personal shame is tough to come back in. That's what stops them from coming back. Not the people.
Yeah, I agree.
People are glad to see them. We're glad to see him back. I don't care how long it is, how long they talked. If they're back, we're glad.
Well, and that's what the experience was. I mean, I'm a third party standing outside, and I'm just hearing, you know, kind of what happened, and I don't know. I wasn't there. I wasn't with, you know, I wasn't a party to those meetings or what, you know, how. I just, you know, this was somebody's speculation about how she felt.
No, I personally believe it's an inside job. It was her own personal demons got her.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
So can we talk for a moment about veterans? Ever since I began serving in the jails and prisons, it's entered my mind that just as much or more effort needs to be expended in the direction of veterans. What are some ways that I can serve veterans? I appreciate them so much for all their service to our freedom.
Right. And I don't know if you are near a base or a medical center. We are. I mean, there is a medical center in our community, and so we're able to work in partnership with the local VA hospital. And
We have the DeBakey Medical Center downtown Houston.
Okay. So one of the things that the VA has done, and it's pretty miraculous, in 2003, they decided that they were going to switch to a recovery model rather than an old model. So they started implementing in 2005. And so they've been working on this whole thing for quite a while. And now all the VA medical centers have local recovery coordinators, and that person's job is to train every new staff person on the recovery model and make sure that that's what's happening. So they're doing things where they now have peer specialists who are veterans who, you know, may have a mental health issue, may have substance abuse or both, but they then get trained and they help run groups, and they're a part of the whole process. And, I mean, it's just phenomenal to watch how things have changed. And one of the things you're seeing is a lot of the stigma starting to go away.
because we're accepting people for who they are. And, you know, and not having, you know, not having those negative perceptions about what addiction means or what mental health means. And, you know, I mean, I've been so impressed. So that's one of the things that, you know, I'm sure that you could certainly contact, you know, they probably have a residential substance abuse treatment program that you could get involved with those and be a part of those groups. And, you know, I would just contact your local DA hospital because that would be the best way to help do activities with them. I know they're always looking for mentors and things like that too. So that's what I
Yes. I did find that on the web, and they have a volunteer coordinator, and so I filled that form out today, actually, and sent it off.
Sure.
So it'll take a couple of days. But in your experience, do they use people volunteering, or is it paid staff?
Well, they use a variety. They have one of the things that's really neat is with peer specialists, which are veterans who, like I said, have recovered or in recovery from substance abuse or mental health. They actually work for the VA, and so then they help run groups. And so I know that I don't know if you're a veteran or not, but I know that a lot of times veterans feel much more comfortable with other veterans because they have their own culture in that they've, you know, they've served in the military, so they have an understanding that makes them brothers or ancestors. And so, so that's one of the things I think is really important. But I think anybody who definitely has empathy can definitely be helpful. And, you know, you can never have too many support systems in your life. So, and, you know, I would recommend it. And I know that, you know, there might be special skills that you can take that would be helpful. And especially with the work you do with families, because, you know,
yes,
a lot of these veterans have families that are, you know, and you know the devastation of addiction with families. So I think there's all kinds of potential opportunities there for you.
That sounds great. I'm also experienced and certified in EMDR to help treat PTSD.
Oh, are you familiar? Yes, PTSD is definitely a big thing. And that's one of the things that the VA has. They've developed a website, and it's called Make the Connection. And let's see, did I just unplug this? Okay. And it's called MakeTheConnection.net, and it's really trying to get the message out that there's strength in asking for help.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear us?
Let me see if I can turn this up. Okay.
Can you hear me?
I can't. Sorry. Don't want to ruin your show.
That's okay. We do that.
No, we're doing great.
We don't need any help.
Well, definitely PTSD is a big thing that lots of folks are dealing with. And, you know, the culture has been such that you never want to admit that you have what you would perceive as a weakness because it can impact your career. But they're really trying to get folks to realize that there's help out there and it's okay to ask for help, and it takes courage to ask for help. And so I think that's really important because that website has lots of stories of other veterans in, you know, how they knew they needed help and how they got it, so that people can look and see that other people are, you know, have gotten help and aren't being negatively impacted by that.
That's great. I had checked it out. Matter of fact, just came up recently at the Bakey Center Thursday nights at 6:30. There's AA meetings and other veterans. I'm a combat veteran, so and I had been planning on getting up there.
Good. They need you.
I know. It's just I do so much. I need me sometimes too, but yeah, I know.
Well, you got it. You know, I always
you
gotta,
yeah.
that analogy of being on the airplane when they go, you have to put the air mask on yourself first before you put it on somebody else, because you gotta take care of you, and that has to come first and foremost. So. Or you can't be helpful to anybody else.
Yeah, but I think I could be a help up there, at least going up. Getting the website out to them. I think the website's just a really great resource. I mean, if you've been to it, it's got some really good insights, and it's all practical experience and insights that are normally not available to folks in the program, especially new people. You know, a lot of the old timers have a hard time with me because it's just nobody's ever really quite done it like this before. So this is new and it's kind of, you know, strange territory. But they know the big book. You know, the old timers, they've been around a long time. They know the program. What they forget is when the new person comes in, they don't know anything. And this is such a good way of giving them a kickstart in the right direction. Instead of letting them linger in the meetings. You know, the meetings have taken on, and I think this is a problem with AA, but the meetings have taken on the emphasis of the solution. The meetings are not the solution. The 12-step work with the sponsor is the solution. That's the solution.
Right.
The meetings are the fellowship. Yeah, and it's a triangle. It's the unity, and it's okay. But all the weight has been put on one side of the triangle. You know, and we tell the newcomer 90 meetings in 90 days, and I still agree with that. I think that's a good idea. But we also tell them,
that's in our contract. Everybody who comes in agrees to that.
Yeah, and I try the other way. No, that's a great idea. But we also tell them meeting makers make it. And that's not always the case. And we tell them, your next meeting is your most important meeting. And if people we find that eventually drink, stop going to meetings. So we keep hammering the fact that you've got to go to another meeting. Now, we start the meetings with a prayer. Most of them are all over the place. It's called an invocation. All recovery meetings, regardless of the topic spin, are gratitude meetings. An attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God, and we end the meetings with a prayer. It's called a benediction, thanking for the spirit to be with us. So what did you get out of the meeting? You got a spiritual bump. I'm an addict. What am I concerned about? When's my next bump? When's my next bump? So I keep coming to the meetings to get my spiritual bump. I'm not really in recovery, but I am staying sober, and I'm being fulfilled spiritually as long as I go to a meeting at least every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how a lot of folks end up staying sober. And you go like, but one guy said, you know, he did that for 8 years, and then he was in a place where he couldn't get to a meeting. And he hadn't worked the fourth step yet. And he said he barely made it back in. So the steps have taken, the emphasis has gone away from the steps, and have gone into the meetings, which is an easier, softer way. I call it getting the program of recovery through the process of osmosis. You ever hear of osmosis? If you sit in enough meetings.
Is it like osmosis?
Yes, it's like exactly like osmosis. If you sit in enough meetings, the message comes to the floor, up the chair, up your butt, and into your head, and you found an easier, softer way. And that's the process of osmosis.
So very similar to osmosis.
Yeah.
Different route.
From the sea. Well, this is my experience. This is the stuff I tell folks. No, you got to start working the steps. I tell my new sponsees, I suggest them not to speak in a meeting until they work the fifth step. And we do them pretty quick. We get them through. I, you know, can thorough Rob timely. Get them through as quick as I can, as fast as they want to go. But I'm trying to move them on. After step five, now they can talk in the meetings, because what happens is, as they talk in the meetings early on, the pain goes away. I don't know why, but when you talk in a room of people and you're in pain, that pain dissipates. And once that pain is dissipated, the motivation to work the steps are also gone. So I want that pain as fuel to get them through the steps in a timely manner.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting stuff, right?
Okay, and, I'll think about that. It is.
The old-timers used to say, sit down, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. And I said, well, that's awful rude. So they had the right idea. They just didn't get it. The idea was they didn't want to waste the pain, and that pain needs to be used as fuel to get them through the steps in a timely manner and then get them working with another alcoholic. Now they have the greatest chance of attaining and maintaining long-term sobriety. That's how it used to work. It used to be 50% got well right away and another 25% after a couple of relapses. 75% recovery is unheard of today, but that's how they did it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
okay, well, that's
I
enough
mean,
out of me.
Well,
so,
I can tell you part. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say about the veterans. I could see there's a there's one fellow we had on, and he's working with a lot with the veterans now. Veterans Homes, should put you two guys together. I think you'd have a lot to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have 4 houses that are exclusively for veterans, so we're able to serve 30 individuals at a time. We have a small women's house, so we do our serving female veterans as well. So I'd be glad to talk to him. But I was going to share part of my story in that I'm not a person in recovery. I am, however, the parent, the proud parent of one son who's in recovery, and he's about to hit 11 years. So I'm very excited about that. And he's doing very well. But I'm also the mother of a son who didn't make it. And my son did pass away about almost 3 years ago from a prescription drug overdose. And it certainly brought me to, since I had been working with people with addictions for 11 years, and it certainly brought me to a professional and a personal crisis. And here is, you know, one addict that, you know, I would have done anything in my power to save, and I couldn't. And so I really had to think about if I could continue to work in this arena, because I was struggling with it. And and I just threw myself into research, and I wasn't aware of how profound prescription drug abuse was at that time.
Oh,
I knew that issue with our veterans, but I didn't realize how much of it was out there. So that was some of, you know, what I came to understand with Mike's death, was how profound it is and how it just keeps getting worse. And so one of the things, you know, I thought, gosh, here we are, Ship, we've been this village down the river, we've been pulling these babies out, trying to help them save themselves, and my own baby goes down the river, and I get a grip on him, but then lose it during the night and lost him. And so I decided that what I needed to do was I needed to take a journey up the river. So I've been doing a lot of work in the community, and actually we're doing four of us from our agency are going to the Fed Up Coalition rally on September 28th in Washington, D.C. at the White House, where we will be rallying about some kind of federal response to the opiate epidemic that we're currently experiencing. This is a group of organizations throughout the country that have mostly been started by parents who've lost children. And so there's a lot of people that are very, very dedicated to this. And so we're looking at, you know, the FDA and some of the choices they've made about going ahead and approving even more opiates that are dangerous. And anyway, so that's...
Well, you're going up against the drug, the giant drug company,
oh, I know,
cartels. Good luck. Yeah, they're,
well,
they're...
but you know what? We're going to do something. And, yeah, we know. I mean, we know we're up against Big Pharma, and they've got lots of money. And, you know, but well, hopefully we can, you know, hopefully we can make a difference.
So
we
you want them to change
level,
the laws, or you
the
want
planet.
Them? You want them to tighten up the well, regulations? Is that what it is? That's what you're going for?
Well, it depends. I mean, there's lots of different ways you can handle it. I know, like in the state of Washington, they've actually developed protocols that limit the amount of opiates that can be prescribed at any one time, so people aren't getting, you know, one of the things that has happened that's very positive that will be happening, I think October 1st, is hydrocodone gets moved to from Schedule 3 to a Schedule 2. So it's going to require more oversight. My son, he had a lethal dose of hydrocodone, which was a Schedule 3, and they could, you know, write prescriptions. They didn't have to go visit the doctor to refill it and all that stuff. But what I am doing is more work around awareness to try to get parents, because one of the statistics that I found when I was researching this was 70% of the people who misuse or abuse prescription drugs are getting them from friends and relatives. So
yes,
you know, if we can stop that 70% diversion, that can help reduce the amount of drugs that are out there that people can get addicted to and die from. And so one of the things that we decided to do was to actually try to work on saving. I mean, I've lost, you know, my child, and, you know, for me, that generation. So, but he has a son who's 8, and I don't want to lose that generation. So I started thinking about my grandson, Jamin. And, you know, he was 5 and a half when his dad passed away. And I started thinking about him and what he liked to do. He likes to play video games, and he likes superheroes. So we actually worked with some IT students at Boise State University who developed a mobile application with a game that teaches kids in K through third grade about prescription drug safety. And what we're trying to do is find an activity that kids enjoy, like video games, and it's mobile, so it can play on your smartphone or your tablet, or you can play it on a desktop as well. But it teaches them about prescription drug safety, and we have a superhero, and his name is Pharmacist Phil. And
I've seen him.
And so he helps teach kids about locking up your meds and dispose of unused meds properly, and only use one pharmacy, and take meds as prescribed and don't share. So those are the four learning objectives. So what we're hoping to do is engage the kids, and through that is then bring the parents in when the kids are going or calling mom and dad out, because, you know what, these medications aren't locked up. Pharmacist Phil says you're supposed to lock up your meds. So we're
That's a great idea.
We're very excited. We're actually, when we go to Washington, D.C. for the rally, the following Monday we'll be meeting with the director of demand reduction with the White House's Office on Drug Control Policy, and because she is very interested in prevention and kids programs. So who knows? We're hoping that we can get this to go national. So
that's great.
Because if we can get started when they're kindergartners and there's, you know, they know that medicine should be locked up, parents will listen to that. Because I can remember my grandson going, "Nana, you don't have your seatbelt on," and you know.
Yeah, my granddaughter's like that too. She won't let me drive. She won't let me drive if I have my seatbelt on.
And so, you know, so what we were trying to do is that kind of thing that changes behavior like, you know, I can remember when we played with yard darts that were really dangerous, and we didn't wear bicycle helmets, and, you know, we didn't wear our seat belts, but now we do, because, you know, because we've done the work to change that perception at an earlier age. And so there's this expectation. So that's what we're trying to do, is create an expectation that medicine would be locked up. And we're actually working with a company now to partner with them. And so we're going to co-brand with them. And so Pharmacist Phil will actually be on these med safes that are that we're working with this company on. So. Yeah.
What is
so
it? Now, I understand it was like a 250,000 people die every year from accidental overdose on prescription drugs. Is it more than?
I know that it's like every 19 minutes somebody in the U.S. dies from a drug overdose, and about 75% of those are prescription drugs. So prescription drugs.
That is
are
incredible.
More than heroin and cocaine deaths each year. And so, I mean, when I start looking at, like, the data in Idaho, you know, we had, like, I think it was 6 heroin deaths in, like, 2010 or whatever it was. And, you know, and then you start looking at hydrocodone, oxycodone, and all of those different things. I mean, it's just, it's like 90% of the drug death.
Jeez.
Were prescription drugs. And so, I mean, I was really surprised too in that, you know, antidepressants were a high number as well. And, you know, it was, anyway, it's frustrating. And very
antidepressants, what would that be like? Xanax?
Xanax, now that's a benzodiazepine, and so, but yeah, my son actually had taken Xanax and hydrocodone and a muscle relaxer, which law enforcement calls the Holy Trinity, meaning that that combination sends you to heaven, and that's exactly what it did to him, so.
Wow. And let me comment also, I really enjoy attending Celebrate Recovery myself and get a lot of good out of that. One of the families there, the husband was telling a story about the day before, the wife had asked him, since when have the laws of physics changed? And he said, what do you mean? And she said, well, I didn't think vodka froze. And what they were talking about is that they had vodka in the freezer. Many people keep vodka in the freezer. And now she went to her vodka bottle, but it was frozen solid because they found out that their 14-year-old had been taking vodka out, water in, and now he was busted. So... The statistic that is most alarming to me is that every day more people die from alcohol overdose than all the drug overdoses combined.
Oh, yeah.
Everything.
Alcohol is worse. Yes.
Well,
yes,
it's the drug of most convenience.
In addition to locking up their prescription meds, I encourage to lock up their liquor cabinets. Because there's such a high danger there.
Yes, that too. And
so the only thing that he could have did was put clear antifreeze in the bottle. That would have worked.
Where do you buy that?
Yeah, Pep Boys.
Yeah, but I think then you get some other kind of poisoning, don't you?
you do. Yeah, the matter of fact, back in the day when they had it's denatured wood alcohol, and they would use that in the radiators to the automobiles. The street drunks would drain the radiators and drink that and go blind.
Oh my God!
Yeah. It's alcohol, you know. It's a wood grain alcohol.
Yeah.
But anyway. All right, well, this is great.
Yeah.
So is there any last words you have for us, Melanie?
Well, I don't know. Other than, you know, lock up your meds and dispose of them properly, those are ways that we can make our community safer if we get rid of that 70% of, drugs that are diverted and used inappropriately. So that would be my last thoughts, I think.
Amen.
And you, Harold, got any last words?
Well, I really, really have enjoyed meeting Melanie and listening. And I'm real excited about the possibility of not only working in the prisons, but working with veterans. I think they are very deserving. Some have given all have given some, and some have given all.
Right. And one of the things we've found is, too, at least locally, about 10% of our prison population are veterans. So there's some, you may have the opportunity to work with some veterans in the prison work you do as well.
Good reminder.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for agreeing. You know, the saying on the walls of AA, you know it, Harold, right? When anytime the hand of AA reaches out, I'm responsible.
Yes.
So, thanks again. And in closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. We're very popular. Matter of fact, one of the most popular places where I was in Nepal. You know why?
Why?
They like our yak. So next time you're looking for good sponsorship information, tune us in. It's the website is rumradio.org. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.